Chapter 4. The evening before my first day at Clifton College, my parents took me to a posh Bristol restaurant to mark my rite of passage to fully-fledged public schoolboy. I was mildly aware of the significance of what was being celebrated, but I think that for them it was a milestone. They were proud that they were sending me to a good school, and they were also proud of the hint of upward social mobility this implied. Not that Clifton was that high in the rankings, comfortably below Rugby and Marlborough, though slightly ahead of Sherborne, I was probably on a par with Malvern and Tunbridge and even Haileybury. These small gradations in the pecking order were a major preoccupation. Quite where Clifton stood in relation to Uppingham and Oundle, I never fully worked out. But the thrill of the evening for me was the food. It was the first really fine meal I'd ever had, and the experience was comparable to the moment when I had first watched people playing Monopoly. A whole new world opened up, elegant, exotic, leisurely, and intensely pleasurable. I had never known that food could taste this good. Even my mind seemed stimulated by it, and that delight has never gone away. Indeed, I find at the age of 76 that food tastes better than ever. In fact, I eat nothing else. There are, in fact, only three comestibles that I do not allow to pass my lips: celery, sea urchin, and raw human flesh. Strangely enough, my memory of the meal eclipses that of my first few weeks at Clifton, but I think that's because my life as a new boy was very ordinary. Now that I was growing up, I turned 14 during my first month at Clifton, nothing seemed as impressive or daunting as it had been at my early days at St. Peter's Prep School. The masters were people, not titans, and had no power of life or death over me. There was also something very undramatic about my new school life. It was calm and businesslike and brisk, almost matter-of-fact, because Clifton was thoroughly middle of the road in all things. It was a kind school in which there was no bullying, a well-mannered, unexceptional and decent place, and so strangely unmemorable. It was, however, big. There were about 700 boys, the vast majority of whom were boarders, split up into 8 houses where they slept and spent their spare time. The day boys were divided between 2 further houses, North Town and South Town, depending on what part of Bristol they inhabited. My house was North Town, dominated by a large central room lined with fair-sized lockers and with a huge table in the middle surrounded by chairs. Each of us was allocated one of the lockers, which was expected to contain all our possessions and school books. Just off the big room, there were 2 studies, one for the house prefects and the other for the house master. Upstairs were a library and an area where we could play chess or study. And right opposite North Town House, literally across the street, was the entrance to Bristol Zoo, from which throughout the day emanated sounds of gibbons and lions and elephants and wild dogs and parrots and American tourists. I liked these noises. They were reminders of an exciting world beyond. The great advantage of being in a house populated by day boys was that the people I came to like were always around. They did not disappear to various parts of the country for half-term and holidays. As a result, and also because I'd become less wussy and a little more fun to be with, I started to acquire plenty of friends whose houses I would visit. Among this group were a couple of boys I was particularly close to, whose curious, playful and slightly mischievous matiness brought out a correspondingly larky part of me that had been dormant these past 14 years. Adrian Upton is now Professor of Medicine, Neurology, at McMaster University in Canada, with a list of degrees as long as your leg. Michael Apter is a psychologist who originated reversal theory. He has held visiting professorships all over the planet and now works with Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. They were brighter than me, but the 3 of us would use the big room to carry out prank experiments that we found both entertaining and revealing. One involved leaving a folded note on the huge table with the name of someone in the house written on the outside, for example, for Foster. The three of us would then lurk and observe just how compelled other boys felt to discover its contents. Almost without fail, they would hang around, glance to see if they were being observed, and then stealthily pick up the note and quickly look inside to find a message like, "Is your name Foster?" or "You are being watched," at which point they would drop it and try to work out if anyone had seen them. Another prank was to swap the contents of two lockers. As each boy's entire life was in his locker, this gave us the opportunity to observe how people behaved when they were really panicked. It struck me that laughter was at the very heart of these closest relationships. The bonhomie and fun bonded us together and allowed me to grow in confidence as I experienced acceptance and support and camaraderie. Of course, as young males, we never talked about our feelings, but we discussed the insanity of the world, and at long last my personality was developing free of the influence of Dad and Mum, and indeed of any other grown-ups, including the teachers. In retrospect, I can see I was on the way to becoming almost normal. In my view, ordinary everyday sanity is harder for only children to achieve. They have nothing to moderate or dilute a parent's influence. It must be very liberating to be able to share your parents' attention, and indeed to have fellow offspring with whom you can actually discuss parental behaviour. I'm sure I could have dramatically cut the hours I spend in therapy if I'd had a brother, or better still, a sister to whom I could have turned and asked, "What the hell has got into her today?" Of course, I had gone to Clifton primarily to work, which meant to study for exams, and since O, or ordinary, levels were coming up in 2 years, and it seemed undeniably important that I should pass them, I settled down to study the standard subjects: maths, Latin, English, French, history, chemistry, physics, and something else. Now, I found that some of the work, like maths and Latin, was moderately interesting, involving, say, as a good crossword. In physics, I found myself quite intrigued by optics, and in chemistry by atomic theory, and I quite liked studying Macbeth and Henry V. But the rest of the time, in other words, 90% of it, I was completely uninterested in anything I was being taught. This meant that I always had to make a conscious effort to concentrate. If I relaxed even for a few moments, I was away with the fairies. My education, in other words, was a test of my willpower, and I accepted the challenge, to such an extent, indeed, that I think at some level of my teenage consciousness, I truly believe that the whole point of going to school was to learn how to focus attention on subject matter that was of no consequence to me. The message I received at Clifton was, education is not primarily about understanding the world. Its real purpose is character building. As a corollary, I inferred that to study anything in which you had a real interest was, if not exactly cheating, certainly missing the point. I probably had 30 teachers while I was at Clifton, and I liked 28 of them, although few made a real impression. One exception, though, was the diminutive Jumper G. He had fought in both world wars and lived to the age of 101. And he was supposed to teach us English, but he would go off track a lot and tell us great stories, including one particular anecdote that was to assume a much later significance for me. Apparently, in ancient Rome, he said, wrestling matches were sometimes held after dinner to entertain the guests. And on one occasion, the two combatants fought so closely that they became completely enmeshed with one another. The sound of a loud crack followed, at which point one of the wrestlers revealed that his arm had been broken. The referee stepped in to disentangle the two men and then told the other man he had won and discovered he was dead. The moral of the story, according to Jumper G, was, if you don't give up, you can't be beaten. I was less than convinced, but the tale stuck in my mind and 14 years later inspired me to write the scene in Monty Python, The Holy Grail, where the Black Knight refuses to submit even when all his limbs have been severed. There was also a very amusing history master called Litmarsh, who was unable to pronounce the letter R if it came near the beginning of a word. Perhaps that wouldn't have mattered so much if he hadn't made a career decision to specialise in 17th century English history. As it was, he spent all his time wrestling with Roundheads and Loyalists, Oliver Cromwell and Richard Cromwell, Prince Rupert of the Rhine, the Rump Parliament and Pride's Purge, and the Restoration, the Rye House Plot, and the Royal Society. Each R required a strange sideways twist of the lips, followed by a facial tick and a head twitch, and we would therefore carefully construct questions that would give him a good workout. It seemed almost perverse that he was not teaching us the 18th century when he'd only have to mention the Regency and all the rest would have been plain sailing. Mr. Whitmarsh had my number, though. At the end of one term, he wrote in my history report, single sentence, "Cleese indulges in subversive activities at the back of the room." Perhaps the finest all-round entertainer we had was a tall, stooping old dotard with a mass of white hair called Sammy Beechcroft, who, when he spoke, produced a strange buzzing noise as though a bumblebee had become lodged at the bridge of his nose. Fortunately, Sammy taught us about Old Testament, a topic that required no exams, so we were free to amuse ourselves to the limit. He must have been the oldest British teacher in captivity, because when he talked about biblical events, he seemed to have personal memories of them. Nobody could understand why, at his age, he was still on the staff. It was assumed that he had something on the headmaster. He moved very carefully around the classroom like an arthritic gecko, but what was funniest about him was the slowness with which he responded to stimuli. It was as though his whole nervous system had been switched to proceed with care, so that his neurons moved very warily, eyeing each synapse for some time before daring to jump. Sammy's reaction speed was best illustrated the time that a classmate named Cleve decided to hide behind the blackboard. This was a large affair in one corner of the room which could be slid upwards after the teacher had written on it, so that it could be more easily seen from the back of the room. Cleve squeezed behind it before Sammy arrived, and we pulled it down to writing height so that only his legs were visible. Now Sammy came in, and failing to notice anything unusual, walked straight to the board, pulled out a piece of chalk, and started to list profits, his writing hand never moving more than a foot or so from Cleve's nose on the other side. This kept the class beguiled for about half an hour. Finally, Sammy finished and slid the board smoothly upwards to find himself standing about 18 inches away from the motionless Cleve. What was so funny now was not that he jumped a foot in the air, higher than he'd been for several decades, but that 3 seconds elapsed between his first seeing Cleve and his jump. In comedic terms, it was the classic single take, the finest I've ever seen. My own contributions to the Let's Surprise Sammy B competition were comparatively low-key. At this time, I had a pair of National Health glasses, which were contained in a hard spectacle case that made a vaguely metallic ringing noise when it was closed. I would open it, hold it behind my back, open my mouth, and when Sammy looked at me, I would shut my mouth hard and the spectacle case simultaneously, creating the impression that closing my mouth caused a weird clanging noise. He would stare each time, but never pursued the matter. Early on, I took to wearing my glasses upside down. The first time I did this, the effect was sufficiently remarkable to stop him in his tracks mid-sentence. He stared at me for a full 5 seconds, and then went on as though nothing had happened. Thereafter, I wore my glasses upside down on a regular basis twice a week, until near the end of term, when he glanced at me and said, quite casually, "Cleve, put your glasses on the right way up." It had taken him about 10 weeks to react. There were 2 Clifton masters I did not like, Billy Williams, a joyless dwarf who ran my house, and a physics teacher I had in my second year called Hazelton. He was a largish, rather shaggy man who spoke in a strange, very deliberate way, while whistling slightly through his lower teeth. After I'd been in his class a few weeks, he looked at me thoughtfully and said, "Ah, Cliche, sir, your housemaster says you're intelligent." "Oh, I don't see it myself." I wasn't hurt or surprised. I took this remark as pure information. It was only when I recalled this many years later I found myself thinking, what was he intending to achieve with this remark? And I came to the conclusion that it made him feel better about himself, the same reason people read snide gossip columns. Of course, the relief experience when anyone, is put down is very transient, but for people like Hazelton, it's probably better than nothing. His persona seemed very odd to me. It was as though he'd once seen an intellectual and had spent the rest of his life impersonating him. Since the tiny scholarship that I'd won to Clifton was in maths, it was assumed by the authorities from day one that I would specialise in science, so I assumed too. Dad had told me that the country was crying out for scientists. There was one subject that would have interested me had I known it existed, but it wasn't on the Clifton syllabus, and that was psychology. After all, why waste good schooling time on studying the workings of the human mind when there were crucial life skills to acquire, like trigonometry or Old Testament history, or how to ask a question in Latin if you expect the answer no? Let's keep a sense of proportion here. So, my introduction to psychology had to come from other sources, notably the BBC, who during my time at Clifton showed a number of thoughtful programmes on the subject. One that I remember particularly vividly showed a volunteer being hypnotised to pour water from a vase of flowers onto the floor. The thing that intrigued me about this was not that he followed orders, but that when the hypnotist asked him why he'd done so, he started rationalising his behaviour, claiming that he thought he'd seen smoke rising from an unextinguished cigarette stub and therefore felt he had to take action to extinguish a possible fire. I was also interested in B.F. Skinner and his conditioning of the behaviour of rats and pigeons, and Solomon Asher's experiments about the need to conform, and later by Stanley Milgram's famous obedience tests. Because the workings of the mind seemed to me to be associated with laboratories and experiments, I formed an almost subconscious plan to head towards biology. And once O-levels were safely out of the way, I asked the science school if I could move to the biology stream for my A-levels. They said yes and proceeded to put me in the care of Dr. Davy, who allegedly taught botany, and Dr. Stubbs, who made the same claim about zoology. Both were believed to be largely nocturnal, but they had been known to appear in the classroom during the day, moving around a little and even making talking noises, though so quietly that you could never be sure that they weren't just breathing harder than usual. Whoever thought they could control a class should have asked for his money back. The two of them, working in tandem, couldn't have kept a class of teddy bears in order if they'd both been given revolvers. From the beginning, my classmates and I were mystified about what we were supposed to do. Ignore them? Try to encourage them to greater efforts, or just to feed them now and again? Our third main A-levels teacher, who took the physics classes, was better. Not a lot, but slightly. He was called Lindsay Jones, or Flimsy Bones, and we liked him. No one, however, paid much attention to him, so when, after a few weeks, he gave us an exam, and I saw that I had come fourth with only 28% in quite a large class, the writing was on the blackboard. In a way, I'm quite proud of what I did next. I had enough self-knowledge to know, round about my 16th birthday, that I had nowhere near the capacity to direct my own studies, and that what I needed, if I was to pass my A-levels, was good teachers. So, I went to the authorities and asked to switch to the maths, physics and chemistry stream, and I was then safe, because I had three really good teachers, Mr. Liddell for maths, Peter Stinker Davies for chemistry, and Freddie Mee for physics. The latter two were rather good fun, too, even if Freddie had a touch of the Dolmans about him. and the three of them got me through my A-levels by making their subjects clear and providing discipline and structure, everything that you need when you're not remotely interested. Bless them. If work is best defined as what you have to do but would rather not, there were two other Clifton activities that qualified: going to chapel and officer training corps, i.e. soldiering for teenagers. Chapel took up a lot of time. Just as at St. Peter's, there was a Church of England service every workday morning, a 15-minute affair which took place in Clifton's remarkably beautiful chapel. Then on Sunday, there was a full one-hour marathon with a proper sermon and hymn singing and crab racing and fire-eating and a trampoline act. To look back on these religious practices from the peak of spiritual perfection that I have now achieved is to wonder, what the fuck did we think we were doing? We'd all been taught how to behave, to walk more slowly than usual when entering chapel, looking downwards, to sit fresh-faced and attentive and slightly awed, as we repeated well-known catchphrases of uncertain meaning: Lord of hosts, Son of God, Paschal Lamb, life everlasting, none of which had ever been explained, but which, if spoken with sufficient sincerity, would apparently keep the bogeyman away. And then to stand and sing obscure lyrics about the hosts of Gilead creeping around in the dark, or rousing military marches like onward Christian soldiers that seem contrary to the idea, blessed are the peacemakers. And then to ask God to do us personal favours, even though the Lord's Prayer taught by Jesus specifically says, "Thy will be done on earth," which clearly indicates it isn't. Yes, I know it's easy to make fun of the organised churches, but has it occurred to anyone to wonder why it's so easy? What gets my goat is that religion should be the most exciting topic of all. Is there an afterlife? Can we have a real purpose to our lives? How can we love our enemy when it seems about as easy as levitating? To what extent is self-interest moral? Is there an experience of the divine that we can achieve? All the vital questions have been dumped in favour of half-baked, po-faced rituals, which are basically a form of middle-class rain dance. Still, it did give me the chapel scene and the meaning of life. The other work took place on Monday afternoons when we all dressed up as soldiers and marched around trying to look enthusiastic that we'd been given the opportunity to exhibit dog-like obedience. But it was useful to me because I realised after about 30 minutes of this that a military life is not an examined one, and so, according to Socrates, is not worth living, especially if you are a fraidy-cat. My sole aims in life have since become not to fight in a war, not to have to give birth, and not to work in finance. So I deem my life a success, even allowing for fierce creatures and my third marriage. After work, there was play, sports and the arts. God, I love sports, except for rugby, of course. They were my raison d'etre. If I could have played cricket for Somerset, football for Bristol City, and squash for fun, I would have died a happy man at 35. And although Clifton was very much a rugby-playing school, in my last year, with the help of two friends, John Phillips and Robert Hill, we got soccer started at Clifton by persuading the head groundsman to give us a pitch out at the playing fields beyond Clifton Suspension Bridge. And I'm proud of this achievement. And in the same year, my cricketing skills improved. I became quite a good off-spin bowler, and I got into the first 11 team and played at Lord's in our annual two-day match against Tunbridge. I scored 30 not out in both innings, and Clifton won for the first time in umpteen years. As for the arts, the best way to give you an idea of the Clifton College perspective is to present you with a single fact. The painting and drawing teacher was a former Scottish rugby football international. For a Christmas present one year, I bought him a painting by numbers set and delivered it by hand. I missed out on music, too many games to be played, and so I have gone through life entirely ignorant of its grammar, when Sir Thomas Beecham said, "The English may not like music, but they absolutely love the noise it makes." I know exactly what he means. Not that all my life was a total cultural desert. Every Easter term there was a house play competition, and in my third year, right out of the blue, I was asked to play a small role in the North Town production of a recent hit, Seagulls Over Sorrento. Quite why I was asked, I don't know. Perhaps it was because my character was called Lofty. I've always remembered the play as a comedy, but apparently it was about a research project concerning a high-explosive torpedo. So perhaps the audience were laughing for the wrong reasons. The following year, North Town put on a production of Dr. Faustus. Two of the boys were interested in acting, so they got the big parts, Faustus and Mephistopheles. I was given the smaller but crucial role of Lucifer, the Prince of Darkness, the embodiment of evil, the Antichrist himself. I realized right from the start that playing Satan gave me a chance to prove myself as a serious straight actor. But I'm afraid it was a devil too far. Part of the problem was my tights. Someone had decided that in order to make my first entrance as terrifying as possible, I should be dressed in starkest black with a scarlet cloak and tights. Now, you know how unmuscular I was, right? My legs were so thin I could have played a flamingo. And yet the director's vision involved putting me, of all people, in black tights. It was clear to me, even at that young age, I knew this was a disastrous choice. But what did I know of the theatrical arts? I left it to the experts. On the day of the dress rehearsal, I stood in pitch darkness behind some black drapes, waiting for the cue for my entrance, accompanied by a junior, whose job it was to show me where the gap in the drapes was to be found. I heard my cue, the boy parted the curtains, and I strode forward to announce, "I am Lucifer." Before I had time even to open my mouth, I was hit by a wall of laughter that shook the building. It wasn't just the tights, of course. It was the idea that this spindly twerp could strike terror into people's hearts when instead of frightening the shit out of them, he was more likely to cause them to wet their pants. I'd created an alternative but unintended form of waste disposal. Thinking quickly and realizing the situation was lost, I ad-libbed instead, "I am ludicrous." Another big laugh. Later that evening, at the actual performance, things began to go downhill. Early in the proceedings, I took up my position behind the black drapes, but this time a different boy was standing there in the darkness. I peered at him. Who are you? Tupman. Gould has a music lesson. So you're parting the drapes for me? What? You're parting the drapes? So I could get on stage? I don't know about that. What? What are you doing here? I don't know, Cleese. He just asked me to stand in for him. And now I can hear my cue coming up in about 10 seconds, so I start groping the drapes in the dark, trying to find the gap myself, desperately grabbing at the pitch-black cloth in search of an opening as the seconds tick away, and there's my cue. So I just walk forward into the drapes, and I keep trudging onward against the weight of all the velvet cloth that is clinging to me, and the audience starts to giggle at the sight of this strange, increasingly large bulge in the back cloth that is ever more slowly making its way towards them. The actors step back in alarm, at least I'm frightening someone, and I manage just to keep moving so that when I have reached a point about halfway to the front row of the stalls, the drapes, at full extension, start sliding back over my head and finally fall back, revealing a strange creature, a lacquered stick insect, apparently in a fright wig, who announces, "I am Lucifer." By which time, most of the audience have lost contact with their chairs. I didn't try straight acting again for another 37 years when I played Kenneth Branagh's tutor, Dr. Waldman, in his film of Frankenstein. But this time, I was a triumph. I didn't get a single laugh, not even when Robert De Niro stabbed me to death. British journalists tend to believe that people who become good at something do so because they seek fame and fortune. This is because these are the sole motives of people who become British journalists. But some people, operating at higher levels of mental health, pursue activities because they actually love them. Thus, I was drawn to comedy in a way I can't quite explain, but can definitely acknowledge. And it was much more than loving to laugh, even if, as a teenager, I was still capable of those helpless, glorious paroxysms when you really want to stop because it's actually hurting too much. For example, I sometimes saw a comedy film or a play that elated me, that excited me, and made me feel there was something going on that I wanted to be connected with. When Dad took me to see my first Marx Brother film, A Night in Casablanca. When we had a school visit to the Bristol Theatre Royal to see N.F. Simpson's One Way Pendulum. When I saw Laughter in Paradise with my favourite comedy actor Alistair Sim. When I watched comedy films produced by the Ealing Studios like The Lady Killers and Kind Hearts and Coronets. Of course, this feeling of being inspired faded away each time, but every now and again it was rekindled like an itch I didn't know how to scratch. Another more eccentric example. Each term at Clifton we were given a blue book, a small soft-covered notebook with masses of information about schedules and lists of masters and boys and the big sports events and so on. We carried it everywhere. Losing it was like mislaying your mobile phone. But I filled mine with humour. Wherever there was a square centimetre of white paper, I wrote the latest good joke I had heard. Nobody else was doing this. In addition, some Saturday nights the Clifton houses would organise entertainments, and now and again I'd do a little sketch or spoof. I learned how to mime to records. On one parents' evening I did a silly orchestra skit with me as conductor. Afterwards, I asked my mother how good it was. I very much hoped she would say, really good. What she actually said was, quite good. On top of all these indications of an unorthodox passion, every evening after I'd had supper and done my prep, I joined my parents in the living room and watched television. And though Dad and I would sometimes look at thrillers or live sport most of the time, it was comedy. The odd thing, in retrospect, was that so many of the best shows then were American. We loved Jack Benny and George Burns and Amos and Andy, now Orwellian non-persons, as they were played by white guys in blackface, and Joan Davis and Ernie Kovacs, and our favourite, Phil Silvers as Sergeant Bilko. Well-written, totally uncontroversial, funny, though not exactly adventurous. The only sign of anything a bit quirky or wild came in variety shows, where wonderful original comics from the era of music hall or variety would do unclassifiable routines. Max Wall, Tommy Cooper, Sid Millwood and the Nitwits, Frankie Howard, Wilson, Keppel and Betty, Professor Jimmy Edwards, Norman Wisdom, Chick Murray. To me, they were the funniest performers, but there were only occasional sightings of them. As a rule, British TV was devoid of zany, madcap, anarchic, crazy, wild, wacky, out of left field, Pythonesque, sorry, I'm jumping ahead, off the ball comedy of the Max Wall variety. But not British radio. Because in the relative backwaters of BBC Radio lurked the greatest radio comedy show of all time, The Goon Show. If you know The Goon Show, fine. If you don't, I envy you, because you are in the incredibly privileged position of being able to listen to it for the very first time. It made the best use of radio that has ever been achieved in comedy, mixing a huge variety of wonderfully silly voices and astonishingly creative sound effects to tell ridiculous stories with humour that was witty, insane, insanely logical, breathtakingly stupid and thoroughly subversive. All three performers have been in the armed forces and held the same views of the officer class. I loved this show with an intensity that almost defies analysis. It was not just that it was wonderfully funny when I listened to it on the wireless in my bedroom, or 2 days later when I prepared myself to hear the repeat by laying the radio on its side of my bed, putting my ear against it, and holding a cushion over my other ear in an attempt to hear the 5 jokes I had missed due to the audience laughter on the original broadcast. It united me with my friends. We adored it. We discussed it, we swapped jokes from it, and it made us feel more alive. In some way, it was cathartic. It exhilarated us by lifting us up above our everyday frustrations and boredoms, gave us a liberating perspective on this odd event unfolding around us called our life. And when, years later, I became bewildered by the reception of Monty Python by some of our looniest fans, I suddenly realized they were experiencing exactly the same combination of emotions that had rendered me such a devotee of the Goons, and so I was able to forgive them. So let us raise a glass to the Goons. Peter Sellers, the greatest voice man of all time, the adorable Harry Secombe, who played the raspberry-blowing nitwit around whom the stories always unfolded, and the great Spike Milligan, the genius who wrote the best radio comedy scripts ever. Salute! And if God had told me that 10 years later I would be performing a Goon show with these 3 titans, I would have ceased to believe in him. Not that we were particularly close at that time. My last year at Clifton started on a sour note. On the first day back, I walked into North Town and strolled up to the notice board to confirm that Mr. Williams, my housemaster, had finally made me a house prefect. This was not an unreasonable assumption. In the summer, I'd been in the school cricket 11, I'd captained the North Town house 11, I'd passed 3 A-levels, completely reorganised the house library, played the lead in the house play, and stolen more cricket equipment from the other houses than had ever been nicked before. Besides, all my other friends were not merely house prefects, but school preposters, official big cheeses. And none of them seemed so vastly superior to me as the discrepancy in our social status would suggest. Not to mention the fact that the position of house prefect was an almost automatic promotion in your last year, no matter how inept, malevolent, and disgusting you were. It never occurred to me that Billy Williams would withhold this trivial act of recognition any longer, but, as you have guessed, he had. I stood there staring at the blank space where my name should have been as I experienced first utter disbelief, then hurt, and then contempt. The hurt was not that I'd wanted to be a house prefect. Actually, that hardly mattered at all. What wounded me was the put-down, the undeserved insult. The dull ache of this stab in the ego began to throb, but was suddenly engulfed in an extraordinary upsurge of high-minded contempt, not just for Williams, but for a system that could ignore merit and allow personal prejudice to produce such a ludicrous decision. It was not fair, and therefore it was unworthy of my respect. It was as simple as that. I believe that this moment changed my perspective on the world. Until then, the example given by my father and the teachers at St. Peter's had fostered in me a belief that people in authority over me were basically fair. Williams's behaviour gave me a terrific jolt, and I responded rather splendidly, throwing away my North Town cap that very day, and borrowing one from Wiseman's house, where many of my friends were located, and wearing it defiantly throughout my last year at Clifton, even inside the North Town house. Up to that point, I had tolerated Williams, but I now realised that I really disliked him, and I knew exactly why. He didn't know the difference between being solemn and being serious. He was a dour, grim little gnome who could not understand that you can try your very best at something and at the same time have fun. Or that you can have a perfectly serious discussion while making your points humorously. No, for him, laughter was a sign of fecklessness. pomposity and humour never go together. To be fair, Williams was not a pompous man. He would have liked to have been, but he was so tiny he simply couldn't pull it off. It's tough being weighty when people can knee you in the head. So he had to make do with the kind of Cromwellian joylessness that banned Christmas puddings. Thus, he wrote in my final school report, "I commend him for his dedication in practising his cricket." Dedication? You might as well praise a boy for his dedication to strawberries and cream or masturbation. "I practised cricket whenever I could because I enjoyed it." Typically, that summer, Williams awarded the House Fielding Prize to a boy who was noticeably bad at it, for no other reason than when he dropped a catch, as he usually did, he cursed so vehemently that it proved just how seriously committed he was to winning the game. Not surprisingly, he had also been made head of house. Much more significant than my disdain for Williams was the fact that I'd started to become sceptical of authority as a whole. I'd always been naughty in class when I thought I could get away with it, but now I began to find my way around school rules and to take the major authority figures less seriously. The school marshal was one victim of my newfound disrespect. Responsible for a wide range of disciplinary matters, he'd always struck me as rather forbidding when he entered the classroom every morning to check on attendance. However, when he asked me a few weeks after the beginning of my micro-revolt why I had missed chapel that day, I told him that I'd been walking along Lower Redland Road and that as I passed the big block of police flats opposite the police station, someone had opened a window on the top floor and thrown a pan of hot fat all over me, and that because of this I'd had to go home to shower and change my clothes. There was a stunned silence. The marshal stared at me, as did the class. I held my nerve, and I looked straight back at him. After about half an hour, he said, "Do you really expect me to believe that?" "Marshal," I replied, "I swear that is exactly what happened." He gave me an odd look, and I knew that he knew that this was an outrageous fib. "All right," he said. Then he ticked his clipboard and left. The class looked at me admiringly. But I think he'd enjoyed it too. I was as surprised as anyone by what had happened. It was completely unplanned, and my sudden boldness startled me. But in a very positive way, it exemplified a growing confidence or independence. Instead of just fitting myself into the school schedules, I was acting more autonomously. And the timing could not have been better. My Cambridge and Oxford entrance exams were coming up, and I needed to be able to wangle my way out of core and games and Old Testament classes so that I could study harder than I'd ever done before. Over the next weeks, I crammed with a fierce discipline that I did not know I possessed, feeling that this was the first really important challenge that I'd ever faced. I liked Cambridge very much when I arrived to take the Downing College exams, but I found the college campus rather bleak. The exam papers not particularly difficult, but then I had no way of knowing what standard was expected. A week later, I was at University College, the oldest of the Oxford colleges, taking the science papers there. Halfway through the physics one, I realised I was not doing well. I'd given two rather sprawling and muddled answers and had fallen badly behind on time. Looking for a calculation question to help me catch up on the clock, I started answering one about rocketry. This was not a good idea, as I had never studied the subject. I had panicked. I finished the 3 hours in total disarray. I knew I had failed a key paper and that there was no way back. I walked around Oxford for the rest of the afternoon, feeling terrible and wondering if I should bother to sit the remaining exams. I got back to the room I was staying in, too gloomy to eat dinner, and then the phone rang and Dad told me I'd been accepted by Downing. But there was a twist to this. Because national service had just been abolished, there was a bottleneck at all the universities. With people who had just completed 2 years military duties immediately after their school days, competing for entry were those who were about to finish their final year at school. So, although I'd been offered a place at Cambridge, I was told that I'd have to wait 2 years after leaving Clifton before I could take it up in October 1960. Not that it concerned me at all. I never even speculated on what I might do to fill this 2 year gap. I still had some 9 months of school left ahead of me, and that took considerations of the future over the horizon for a Cleese who'd only just turned 18. Moreover, I was now encountering a new feeling of spaciousness due to being free for the first time in years from the pressure of exams. I've always noticed that any kind of pressure narrows my awareness and stunts my curiosity, because once I apply my nose to the grindstone, I find it difficult to stick it up in the air again to smell the flowers. Of course, a degree of obsession often produces the best work, but it does not produce the best life. But now, with my place at Cambridge secure, I didn't care whether or not I passed my S-level exams. In fact, although I didn't register the significance at the time, I now paid very little attention to my scientific studies and started to look around for other, more interesting matters. My main criticism of my time at Clifton is that at this point, when any master could easily have steered me in the direction of a new interest, I was left entirely to my own resources. And the truth is, I was not very resourceful. But then, in fairness to me, no teacher ever tried to stimulate my intellectual curiosity either. Nor, in 5 years, did any of them spot that I had any creative abilities whatsoever. I remember writing an essay on time, which I thought rather ingenious. I spent the entire essay explaining how I had failed to get down to writing the essay because I had prevaricated and procrastinated and wasted time. And the last line of the 1,500-word essay was an apology for not having written it. Now, if I'd been a teacher reading this, I would have spotted some talent. Unfortunately, you have to have some creative ability before you can recognize it in others. At Clifton, I don't think any of the masters had this innovative talent, and the institution itself seemed to limit its recognition of it to English essays that contained phrases like carpet of snow and verdant foliage and autumnal hues, and to drawing and painting. So in that last year, no teacher suggested that I should read a particular book or play or try to acquire a new skill or visit an exhibition or anything that would have expanded my intellectual horizons. And these were very limited indeed, given that from 1955 to 1958, of the 36 lessons that I attended each week, 31 were in maths and science, and the remaining 5 in PE and Old Testament studies. I don't blame Clifton for this ludicrous imbalance, as it was dictated by the educational authorities of the time via A-levels. It was only 30 years later, when I read Howard Gardner's Frames of Mind, that I realized there are many different intelligences. Gardner believes there are 9 which are almost unrelated to each other, which helps me to understand why I sometimes think I'm quite bright and sometimes feel like a complete dolt. Of these, the English system of education developed only 2. Logical, mathematical, and linguistic, with 2 others, musical and bodily kinesthetic, worked on outside the classroom. The other 5 were totally ignored. The staff couldn't have taught them anyway. Consequently, it was only in my mid-40s that I realized just how appallingly narrow this English left-brain education was. And this enabled me to finally understand why so many people who'd been academically distinguished did not seem to accomplish a great deal once they left university. So there I was in December 1957 with a place at Cambridge and time to broaden my horizons, but finding no stimulation from Clifton, and lacking the awareness or audacity to strike out on my own in any intellectual direction, I wasted my time and enjoyed myself instead. I read adventure stories like Conan Doyle's The Exploits of Brigadier Gerard and detective stories like Agatha Christie's The Murder of Roger Ackroyd and The Father Brown Tales of G.K. Chesterton. In the spring term, I played soccer every day and pretended to be Tartuffe. We were rehearsing the play for that year's inter-house play competition. I began to realize that these two activities had a lot in common. I really liked being in teams, the collaboration, the team spirit, the in-jokes, the sense of belonging, of support, or probably giving me a sense of family that I'd never really experienced before. And obviously, I'm still at it. One of the happiest memories of the 2014 Python 02 reunion was that the Python team took all the curtain calls together. In the summer, I played cricket and even got the great England player Dennis Compton out twice in one innings. The first time I got him out, stumped, nobody appealed because everyone in the team wanted to watch him bat. The second time, he hit a catch to a boy playing his first match in the first 11. Anyone else would have dropped it deliberately. The score, DCS Compton, caught witty, bold cleese, 27. I also high-jumped 5'6" and took part in a memorable sixth-form entertainment, which took place in an open courtyard right beneath the East Tower. I had decided nonsense German was funny, so I dressed up as Hitler and harangued the audience. After a time, someone in the audience, a plant, objected, and two stormtroopers, the guys who would have become professors in America, arrested him, frog-marched him into the East Tower, and disappeared. I continued my mock Deutsch, my accent was quite good, and then suddenly the plant appeared at the parapet at the very top of the tower above us, screaming, "No, no, for God's sake, no," as the stormtroopers prepared to throw him off. A moment later, a life-size dummy, dressed exactly like the plant, was tossed over the parapet and sailed through the air 5 stories down, while the plant screamed, landing with a huge, dull thump in the courtyard right next to the audience. There was a moment of utter, utter horror. I had achieved something that I'd signally failed to do as Lucifer. There were at least 2 brown trouser jobs. Then, after they realized they'd been had, the biggest laugh that I get till I appeared at the Hollywood Bowl. Actually, this is the only major jape that I arranged at Clifton. Similar other pranks, which are now attributed to me, I'd heard about when I first arrived in 1953. Around about this time, I got an unexpected call from Mr. Tolson at St. Peter's, inviting me to come down to Weston-super-Mare for a chat. He'd heard that I had 2 years to kill before going to Cambridge. Was I interested in teaching at St. Peter's? Sitting in his study a few days later, I felt very tempted. There was, however, a problem. "But, Mr. Tolson, what do you want me to teach?" "I want you to teach the second and third forms, English, history and geography." My heart sank. "But I don't know anything about them, Mr. Tolson. For 3 years I've done nothing but science." Mr. Tolson patted my arm. "John, they're 10-year-olds. Just stay a page ahead." And then he offered me £5 a week. It was a no-brainer. Back at Clifton, it was the last day of term, and by tradition, leavers were allowed to walk out of the chapel first, even before the masters. When this had happened in the past, I'd watched them walk down the aisle with a deep feeling of empathetic sadness. How awful they must feel, I thought, leaving their home, their life at Clifton, their very existence for the last time. My heart would go out to them in their bereavement, really. But now that it was my turn, I felt cheerful and optimistic. It was perfect. I'd got really bored with the place about 6 weeks before, and I was delighted to be out of there. And many times since, I thought, what a really great frame of mind in which to die. I'm bored. I'm out of here. Here's hoping. I wasn't exactly gone, though. A week later, I was still a member of the Clifton College 11 at Lord's, and when I was out, first ball, it didn't matter. The team won. And after playing cricket through the whole summer holiday, I was going back to Weston-super-Mare.